Ladies and gentlemen, I'm glad that Catherine Lane mentioned that you have heard me speak before on Shakespeare, and you will hear me inevitably repeating myself, for which I apologize in advance, because I have to say, as the basic purpose beneath all the mature plays of Shakespeare is the same, really, fundamentally the same, inevitably I have to repeat myself. And I will now say something, probably mention something which I've said before, by way of a start, which is a quotation from Dover Wilson, who was one of the great authorities on Shakespeare in the middle of the century, or the first part of the century. He says, before its final secularization in the first half of the 16th century, our drama was concerned with one topic and one topic only: human salvation. Well, now one could go a little is too little. One could go further than that. One could say that until about 500 years ago, and in the East, much less than that, and going back into the shadows of prehistory, the whole world was fundamentally dominated by one idea. And that was, there were traditions all over the world using different images, that was the tradition that man was created in the image of God as mediator between heaven and earth. And the subsequent loss of that perfection and the loss of the paradise in which it was set, and of how it can be regained. This is something which only the modern world is not preoccupied by, one might say. And at the root of all religion is what in the Greco-Roman antiquity was called the way of the mysteries. That is, the lesser mysteries and the greater mysteries, Mysteria Palpa and Mysteria Magna. And this was used also in many sectors of the Christian world. It spoke of the lesser mysteries and the greater mysteries. And of course, it is from that terminology that the word mystic and mysticism come. Words relating and expressing the inner aspect of all religions. And it is the mysteries which are the theme of both Dante's Divine Comedy and of Shakespeare's mature plays. But of course there is a great difference between these two great poets, apart from the fact that one is essentially an epic poet, the other is very essentially a dramatist. But they were both concerned with the same message. Now, in drama, unlike the Divine Comedy, which can, in epic form, the epic form favors the tracing of starting with the beginning of the lesser mysteries and then going on to the end of the greater mysteries. in Dante's poem, of course, the descent into hell and forms one book. The ascent of the mountain of purgatory forms a second book, and the ascent through the heavens as far as the divine presence itself constitutes the third book. And epic can do that. The epic form is favorable to following in a straight line the course through the mysteries, whereas drama cannot portray such a passage. In Shakespeare, the action is mainly concerned with hell and purgatory, that is, with coming to know one's faults and purification from those faults. And the two processes are partly in Shakespeare simultaneous, as they are, in fact, in the lives of the mystics themselves. But the greater mysteries are nonetheless always in Shakespeare, at least implicit. We have, for example, in Romeo and Juliet, Romeo's dream, very near the end of the play. I dreamed my lady came and found me dead, and breathed such life with kisses in my lips, that I revived and was an emperor. And there's also in Romeo and Juliet the statues of pure gold which are promised for Romeo and Juliet. When Romeo's father says of Juliet that I will raise her statue in pure gold, and Juliet's father immediately says, as rich shall Romeo by his lady lie. That is referring to the greater mysteries very clearly, considering the significance of gold. Then there is, at the end of Hamlet, Horatio's farewell. Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. And then there is the much stressed fact that the bed where Othello and Desdemona lie together in death, on that bed are the wedding sheets. Then there is the conviction of Antony and Cleopatra that they will be united in paradise. Cleopatra, as it were, dies into that union with the words, "Husband, I come." Now to that name, my courage prove my title, when she places the asp to her breast in order to end her life. So much for the plays which precede the play which is our theme tonight, because Cymbeline follows fairly soon after Antony and Cleopatra. There is, of course, in between Pericles, Prince of Tyre. And that belongs, although it is, much of it is clearly not by Shakespeare, it's nonetheless dominated by Shakespeare. One feels that he has the whole structure of the play, the message of the play is his. And that falls into this group of the last plays. Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest. One can begin that triad can become the ternary with the addition of Pericles, which has the same characteristics. And what the profound similarity which all these plays, these final plays, possess is that unlike the others, which end only at the threshold of the greater mysteries, in all these plays, that threshold is crossed either virtually or actually. And all these plays end in an immense and overwhelming happiness, not merely anticipated, but already enjoyed. Also, as Shakespeare goes forward in years, he seems to go back in time. These last plays are perhaps more medieval than the earlier ones. For example, the presence of divine powers, albeit necessarily in pagan disguise. Diana in Pericles, Jupiter in Cymbeline, Apollo in The Winter's Tale, and Juno, Iris, and Ceres in The Tempest. And also another thing, primordial perfection, which is already personified in the earlier plays, is given in these last plays a setting that befits it. Cymbeline's two sons are brought up in virgin nature. Perdita in The Winter's Tale is brought up by shepherds, traditionally associated with primordial innocence. Miranda in The Tempest is brought up on the Enchanted Island. Apart from such differences, relatively superficial, these last plays, like all the mature plays, have an allegorical and an anagogical meaning, together with their literal and moral significance. And the anagogical meaning, which concerns, as always, the way of the mysteries. As to the allegory, the fall of man is represented in Cymbeline by the loss of his two sons, who are the two natures, heavenly and earthly, of primordial man, human and divine, if you like, primordial man. In a sense, both brothers are heavenly because the earth, symbolized by the second, the younger one, is earth as it first was, that is, a paradise penetrated by celestial influences. Shakespeare clearly wishes us, by various things he says in throughout the play, to be reminded by these two brothers of the heavenly twins, Castor and Pollux. And there are various manners of expression throughout the play which suggest this. As to the serpent, enemy of mankind, this is represented by the wicked queen, who is Cymbeline's second wife, and her power is mainly concentrated in Cloten, her degenerate evil son, the son of a previous marriage, not facsimile of the sun. And as the play opens to consolidate her hold over Cymbeline, she is determined to marry Cloten to Cymbeline's daughter Imogen, who is now the king's only heir. Fallen man, that is what we call sometimes every man, because it stands for the play, you know, which is named Every Man. It's named because it is something which concerns everybody, and one can use that term of the main character, the protagonist in most of Shakespeare's plays, as I often do. And in this play, every man, that is, man who has to regain what has been lost by the fall, consists of the king and his daughter. Very often in Shakespeare, you have that duality in the central figure from an anagogical point of view, that is. In Henry IV, there is the prince who represents the new legal king who will replace his father, who was a usurper. That is, from his father's point of view, he looks on his son as someone who will replace him and who will be legal. And after the death of his father, the prince speaks in a way as if he were conscious of being, as it were, a second birth to his father. You have the same thing in The Tempest. The king, King Alonso of Naples, and his son Ferdinand clearly represent together every man. And in this play, Imogen and her father Cymbeline have to be taken from one point of view together. Imogen herself is perfect, one might say, from the beginning. But she is not perfect. That human perfection has not yet been reached because her father is still in the clutches of the serpent represented by Second Life. But unlike all other combinations in Shakespeare, despite the fact that Cymbeline gives his name to the play, he personifies a purely passive, fallen psychic substance, on behalf of which his already virtually perfect daughter has to undergo all the rigors of the lesser mysteries. And it is moreover she who, despite him and on her own initiative, takes the first step on the spiritual path by secretly marrying Posthumus, an orphan of noble family, half adopted by the king. And she does this firstly because she is in love with him, and he with her, but also to escape the marriage with Cloten, which is being plotted by her stepmother, and the king has almost come to agree to it. The play opens with a farewell between Imogen and the now banished Posthumus. Banished by Cymbeline in anger as soon as he heard of the marriage. Imogen gives her husband a diamond ring of great value, which had belonged to her mother, and he gives her a bracelet and leaves his servant Pisanio to help her as best he may. Postumus himself goes to Rome, where he becomes involved in a dispute with a certain Italian named Iachimo, who claims that if given the opportunity, he could easily seduce Postumus's wife. And having already spoken too much in praise of his wife in front of strangers, Postumus now goes to the point even of profanizing his marriage by entering into a wager with Iachimo, according to which, if Iachimo succeeds in winning over Imogen to his desires, Postumus will give him the diamond ring that she had given him. Otherwise, Iachimo will have to give him the equivalent from his own estate. Iachimo goes to the court of Britain with a letter of introduction to Imogen. He starts to woo her, but soon sees that his suit would be hopeless. So he hits on the device of begging her to store overnight in her room for safety a trunk containing valuables which partly belong to her husband. She agrees to do this, and he has the trunk brought to her room with himself inside it. And when she is fast asleep, he ventures out and takes note of the room and its contents, and above all, that she has on her left breast a mole. She is so fast asleep that he is able even to slip from her wrist the bracelet that Postumus had given her. And so Iachimo is able to persuade Postumus that his wife has been unfaithful to him, and that he, Iachimo, has won his wager. Postumus decides that Imogen must die. He sends her a letter telling her to come to Milford Haven on the Welsh coast, where he will meet her. And he sends another letter to Pisanio, his man, telling him to accompany her there and then to kill her as an adulteress. They go to Milford Haven. Pisanio is determined from the start not to carry out his master's orders, but he sees that inevitably Imogen will have to leave the court. So he takes her to Milford Haven. And then he shows her Leonatus's letter to him, Postumus's letter to him. I call him Leonatus. His son name is sometimes Leonatus, sometimes Postumus. Imogen, of course, is absolutely overwhelmed with grief when she reads this letter to Pisanio telling him that she is an adulteress and that he must kill her. She begs Pisanio to kill her. She wants nothing else but to die. Pisanio says that he has a plan for her safety, and that she should put on a young man's dress that he has in fact brought with him, and seek service as a page to the Roman ambassador Lucius, who is due at Milford Haven the next day on his way back from the court of Britain. Augustus, the Emperor Augustus, has sent him to Britain to demand payment of the tribute which Cymbeline's uncle had agreed to pay to Rome, but which the queen has persuaded Cymbeline to stop paying. He still refuses to pay, and Lucius assures him that Rome will come and take it by force. Meantime, Pisanio sends Posthumus news that he has obeyed his instructions and that Imogen is dead. Then, having returned to the court, where now Imogen's absence has been discovered, Pisanio is forced by Cloten, the queen's son, at sword point to tell him where Imogen is. Pisanio, thinking that she will have had plenty of time to sail for Rome with Lucius, tells Cloten that she is at Milford Haven, and Cloten immediately sets off in search of her. She herself, dressed as a page and waiting for Lucius to arrive, comes upon a cave which appears to be inhabited, and faint with hunger, she goes in to ask for food. This cave is the home of her two brothers, Guiderius and Arviragus, who have lived there for some 20 years with the Lord Belarius, whom they look on as their father and who took them with him when he himself was wrongfully banished by Cymbeline. The three of them were out hunting, and they returned to find Imogen in their cave. Immediately and spontaneously, there is a great love between the two brothers and their sister. To return now to the play's highest meaning, Imogen's escape from the court and her journey to Milford Haven in order to make good her marriage is an eloquent image of the lesser mysteries, and it is so fraught with desolation and destitution that she might be said to have already passed through the narrow gate of death. If the other brother herself, namely her father, were not still in the clutches of the enemy. But thanks to Imogen's spiritual striving, those clutches are losing their hold. The queen frets herself into a fever, owing to the absence of her son. And meantime, Imogen's brief encounter with her brothers is a wonderful foretaste of the state of primordial man endowed with two natures, heavenly and earthly. The encounter is brief because Imogen, feeling faint, takes some of the medicine which the queen had given as a present to Pisanio. The queen was extraordinarily cunning. She, in Pisanio's presence, she, instead of giving him this, she let it drop on purpose, and he picked it up, and she thanks him. And then she says, as an afterthought, I may as well give you this. It will cure any sickness that one may have. She herself had thought that it was a deadly poison, but her physician, Cornelius, not trusting her, had concocted for her, instead of a deadly poison, a sleeping draught. And Pisanio gives this, thinking it will be of use to Imogen. He gives this to her, not suspecting that it would be being harm in it. It is a harmless sleeping draught, but it makes the sleeper appear as if they were dead, And Imogen's brothers find her lying there in the cave, and when they've been out hunting, and they think she's dead. And now Cloten arrives on the scene. And he threatens them, and he is killed by Guiderius, the elder of the two brothers. Lucius, finally, the ambassador, comes to Milford Haven, but there he is told that he is to command the Roman forces against Britain, and that he will be joined by other forces under Iachimo. And he finds Imogen, who has just woken from her sleep, and he takes her as his page. She asks if she can serve him, and he takes her as his page. And there's a great love also between those two. It should be mentioned that in this play, Rome, although the enemy of Britain in a sense, has a very positive position. And this Roman ambassador is said to be not only good, but even holy. And Imogen is very happy to serve him as his page. Now, this question of the symbolism whereby a soul